moment. Our ancient sources like to heighten the drama of it. They like to have Scipio and Hannibal meet at a conference before the battle, basically compliment each other on what wonderful generals they are. It's all very patriotic and rousing stuff. But what we can say for sure is that Scipio and Hannibal, whether they actually ever met face to face aside, they fought a major battle at the site of Zama in North Africa, and Scipio emerged victorious. Hannibal was defeated, and Carthage, as a result, was forced to surrender. This was the most titanic struggle that the Romans had faced so far in their imperial career. They came very close to losing not just their sway over their growing empire, but losing everything. Had Hannibal been victorious in Italy, had the careful work of the Roman Confederation of Italy not laid the groundwork for Roman security there and prevented the various communities subject to Rome from defecting to Hannibal, all could have been lost. Roman history could have come to a swift end towards the end of the 3rd century BC. Instead, the Romans emerged victorious. They imposed an even heavier war indemnity on the Carthaginians than they had in the First Punic War, 10,000 talents, three times larger. All Carthaginian territories in Spain were ceded to the Romans. The Punic navy was reduced to 10 ships. And large tracts of land that the Carthaginians had controlled in North Africa were given as a gift to a new Roman ally in the region, the native kingdom of Numidia, which basically occupies modern-day Algeria. As to Hannibal himself, well, he was spared by the Romans and spent the next 20 years traveling the Mediterranean, seeking refuge in various courts of various kings around the Mediterranean. For a time he was with the Seleucids, for instance. Wherever he showed up, the Romans would send an embassy demanding that he be handed over to them, demanding that he be expelled from this court or that court. And 182, 20 years precisely after his defeat at Zama, Hannibal was finally cornered in North Africa and was about to be handed over when he committed suicide, preventing the Romans from ever getting their hands on their single most hated, if begrudgingly admired, enemy. The Second Punic War had several very important consequences for Rome and for Carthage. For the Romans, essentially, it meant absolute mastery of the Western Mediterranean. Carthage, as a power in the Western Mediterranean, had now been humbled, reduced to merely 10 ships. All her former territories, her former areas of activity, Sicily, Sardinia, and Spain, had been taken from her by the Romans, and the city of Carthage itself greatly reduced. The Romans themselves formed their new holdings in Spain into two provinces in 197 BC, which they called, rather unimaginatively, Nearer Spain, which is the northern part, and Further Spain, which is the part furthest from Rome as you enter Spain from the north. In order to secure their holdings in Spain, it was now necessary for the Romans to exercise some control over southern France. By 180 BC, they had also achieved this. But above all, of course, the war heightens or highlights once again the image and power of the Roman control over Italy. Here we have the Romans standing firm at a time of absolute crisis, facing really backs against the wall, facing total defeat and destruction, refusing to negotiate, drawing on the support of their Italian allies to prevail. For Carthage, the Second Punic War meant the loss of everything. Their former ascendancy over the Western Mediterranean had finally been washed away. Even many of their lands as held in North Africa had now been ceded to the neighbouring and hostile kingdom of Numidia. But it was to be worse than that for the Carthaginians, because in 149 BC, in one of the most disgraceful incidents in all of Roman history, the Romans, always suspicious of their former Carthaginian enemies, picked a fight with Carthage, led by the highly conservative and acerbic senator Marcus Porcius Cato, who would precede every speech he gave in the Senate with the phrase Carthago delenda est, Carthage must be destroyed, hammering this message home to the Romans. Finally convinced them that Carthage had to be attacked. 149 BC, Carthage was attacked. Just the city, the Romans picked a fight with them, attacked and besieged Carthage, and gracing it with the official title of the Third Punic War really doesn't do justice to the enormous imbalance in this conflict. The Carthaginians now were fighting for their very existence. And to their credit, they held out for 3 years against the Roman siege. But finally, in 146, the last vestiges of Carthaginian resistance collapsed around their citadel, and the surviving population was deported. The site of Carthage itself was destroyed, razed down to the ground. That's why there's so little archaeological evidence of ancient Punic Carthage left for us to look at. The Romans did a very thorough job of destroying the site in 146 BC. The ground was cursed, although the story common in popular circles that it was seeded with salt appears to have been an invention of the 19th century. It is not testified in any of the ancient sources. The Second Punic War then sees Rome in charge of the entire Western Mediterranean, and the stage is now set for the next phase of Roman expansion, which we look at in the next lecture, which is when the Romans turn their attention eastward to the rich and powerful lands of the Hellenistic kingdoms in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Lecture 14, Rome in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Hello, and welcome to the 14th lecture in the history of ancient Rome. The last time we looked at the tumultuous events of the Second Punic War, and we ended with the postscript on the Third Punic War, as it's so called, in which Rome destroyed the city of Carthage in 146 BC. We left Rome then in control of the western half of the Mediterranean Sea, over which they now had unquestioned mastery. What I want to do in this lecture today is examine the rise of Roman power, rapid rise of Roman power in the eastern Mediterranean, the more complex of the two halves of the Mediterranean Sea in ancient times, with, as we've seen, the Hellenistic kingdoms powerful there. We will, as we have done before, outline only very briefly and in broad brushstrokes the main thrust of these wars, and then we will examine the shape of Roman power, the nature of Roman power, by the period about 160, 170 BC, with examples, two examples of incidents that I believe are illustrative of the extent of Roman power as it extended over now the entire Mediterranean Sea by about 170 BC. For contemporaries, the emergence of Rome onto the civilized stage, as they would have conceived it, the eastern half of the Mediterranean, was a bewildering event indeed. Polybius, who, as we have seen, was a Greek hostage, held at Rome, although not held in strict confinement, but kept under house arrest of sorts at Rome, but friends of the Cornelii Scipiones, leading family that had produced, for instance, the man who defeated Hannibal, Scipio, Publius Cornelius Scipio, later named Africanus, the conqueror of Africa for his victory over Hannibal in 202 BC. Polybius was well in with this family and managed to observe Roman affairs from first hand. And he was motivated, he tells us, to write his history of Rome at all, specifically to address the question of how the Romans managed what he considered to be a remarkable achievement, the conquest of what he regarded as the entire civilized world in the space of a little over 50 years. He introduces his history with the following statement. There can surely be nobody so petty or so apathetic in his outlook that he has no desire to discover by what means and under what system of government the Romans succeeded in less than 53 years in bringing under their rule almost the whole of the inhabited world, an achievement which is without parallel in human history. That was Polybius' statement of why he wrote his history. And indeed it was a bewildering and remarkable achievement. The Romans were drawn eastward initially with conflicts with Macedon, which is what we look at first. I intend, by the way, to look at Rome's conflicts with the two major eastern powers, Macedon and then Seleucid Syria, in sequence, even though chronologically they overlap somewhat. I want to focus more on the regions rather than adopting a strictly diachronic chronological outline of events, which would, I think, be overly confusing. So let's first of all deal with Rome's involvement with Macedon, then we look at the situation with regard to Syria and the Seleucid kingdom there. Macedon was the first of the Hellenistic kingdoms to draw the close attention of Rome, and really, in many ways, they're responsible for it themselves. Because after the Battle of Cannae in Italy, the king of Macedon, a man called Philip V, who was an ambitious man indeed, made a pact with Hannibal. He figured that after Cannae, Roman power in Italy would be forever broken. So he made overtures to the Carthaginian hero and formed an alliance with Hannibal in 215 BC. For the Romans, this raised a rather harrowing possibility, namely Hannibal being reinforced from across the Adriatic Sea with fully trained, well-equipped Macedonian troops. This may have changed the face of the war in Italy considerably had it happened. Remarkably, even though they were in the depths of their despair following the defeat at Cannae and trying to reconstruct their forces after that catastrophe, they rustled up a force and sent it over to Greece in 215 BC. This is called the First Macedonian War, and really it's nothing in particular. It's a series of skirmishes, often the Romans operating by fomenting rebellion among Philip's subjects in northern Greece and on the outskirts of Macedonian territory. After a series of skirmishes, the war came to a negotiated end in 204 BC. So it really was something of a non-event, graced with the title the First Macedonian War. It wasn't really anything in particular. It does reveal something again of the Roman ability, Roman desire to fight an enemy once identified, even when they're in the depths of their troubles with Hannibal. But nevertheless, it wasn't really a major event. The one effect of it, however, was that the Romans had identified a new enemy. They regarded Philip now with considerable suspicion, and they had identified him as a potential problem for the future. Well, the future wasn't too long in coming, because within 15 years, in 200 BC, the Second Macedonian War was underway. This war was brought about predominantly by Rome's allies in the east, Pergamum and Rhodes. We have seen these two Hellenistic states, small buffer states between the major powers of the Ptolemies in Egypt, the Seleucids in Syria, and the Antigonids in Macedon. These two states had become allies, friends of the Roman people, and they revealed to the Romans around 201 or so BC that Philip had come to an agreement. A non-aggression pact had been signed between Philip of Macedon and King Antiochus III of Seleucid Syria. This was worrisome because it meant that the two traditional enemies of each other might now be joining forces, or at least turning a blind eye to each other's activities in the Mediterranean Sea. Pergamon and Rhodes, both of whom were taking the brunt of Philip V's new aggression in the Eastern Mediterranean, appealed to Rome. The Romans were reluctant to get involved in a further war. They had just finished the Second Punic War, they were exhausted, and were most reluctant to get involved in yet another foreign adventure. But when the Pergamene and Rhodian ambassadors revealed this secret pact between Philip and Antiochus, the Romans became fearful and voted to embark on yet another war across the seas. By the way, since this so-called secret pact between Antiochus and Philip was revealed to the Romans by the Pergamenes and the Rhodians, specifically to induce the Romans to intervene in their affairs and to protect them from Philip's aggression in the Eastern Mediterranean, some modern scholars have regarded it as a fiction. They've regarded it as an invention of the ambassadors, of the Eastern ambassadors, to convince Rome to act. Well, whatever the case, the Romans believed that there was a non-aggression pact and voted for war. The Second Macedonian War stretched from 200 BC to 196 and was again fought between Rome and Philip V. The first few years of the war were non-events, the two armies manoeuvring gingerly in the mountainous terrain of Macedon, diplomatic efforts being made to resolve the war, but nothing decisive happening until, by accident, the two sides bumped into each other in 197 BC around a ridge in Macedon, or at least in northern Greece, called Dog's Head, Cynocephali. The two armies were marching along either side of this ridge, unaware of each other's presence, when scouts on top of the ridge spotted the enemy simultaneously. There was a race for the top of the ridge. Whoever gained the high ground would undoubtedly have the advantage. The Macedonians got there first. The Roman legions were still forming up in their battle line when the Macedonians came charging down the ridge on top of them and swept all before them. It looked as if the Macedonians and King Philip would be victorious when the Roman army stood firm. Its retreat stopped and they held the Macedonian phalanx in place. At this time, a colonel, the equivalent of a colonel, a man called the Tribune of the Soldiers, which is a low-ranking officer, on the right wing of the Roman army, observed that the opposite side of the Macedonian army had not fully formed up. He detached several units from his side of the Roman army and assaulted the still unformed left flank of the Macedonian army. He was victorious and then swung his victorious sections of the Roman army around and attacked the rear of the Macedonian phalanx held firm by the main Roman line. It's a fine example of Roman military superiority. In the next lecture, we'll examine something of the nature of the Roman army, its organizational principles, and its tactical abilities and so forth, in the next lecture when we seek explanations for the rise of the Roman Empire. The Battle of Cynocephali, the Battle of Dog's Head, then is a good example of the superiority of the Roman legions over even so well-trained and well-equipped an armament as the Macedonian phalanx. With his army defeated, Philip was forced to negotiate a peace with the Romans, which he did, and essentially was debarred from interfering again in the affairs of Greece or the Aegean Sea. For the Greeks, south of Macedon, people who'd always felt themselves under the thumbs of the Macedonians, the Second Macedonian War was also important. For the Romans, at the Pan-Hellenic Games at Isthmia in 196 BC, the Romans declared the Greeks free. And in 194, they withdrew all their military forces from the Balkan region. So it looked as if the Romans were genuinely not interested in extending their power permanently into the region. What people didn't seem to understand was that the Romans now considered themselves to be the protectors of the Greeks. And they had really on hand a perpetual excuse for interference in Eastern affairs should they ever need one in the future. For the rest of his reign, Philip V towed the Roman line. He died in 179 BC and was succeeded by his son, Perseus. Perseus took a more aggressive line with regard to Roman limitations on his abilities as a king. And so he began to behave slightly more aggressively towards the Greeks to his south and towards the Aegean Sea to his east. The Romans, again, I'm cutting the long story short here, the Romans initiated a series of diplomatic efforts to prevent him from acting. They failed, and ultimately the two sides slid into war, almost out of apathy, in 172 BC. This was the Third Macedonian War, and it lasted from 172 to 168 BC. After 3 years of not particularly effective manoeuvring in northern Greece and Macedon, Roman legions and the Macedonian phalanx once more faced off over the plain of Pydna in northern Greece under the shadow of Mount Olympus, the mythical home of the Greek gods. The Macedonian phalanx charged across the plain and crashed into the Roman legions. the Roman general on the spot, a man called Lucius Aemilius Paulus, who was a friend of Polybius, a personal friend of Polybius, later commented that he'd never seen or heard anything more frightening in his life than that charge. 20,000 men with pikes several meters long, running, shouting at his army, and smashing into the line with tremendous violence and force. Yet the Roman line held, and in fact broke the Macedonian line, and utterly defeated the phalanx in battle again. According to our figures, some 20,000 Macedonians were killed for the loss of only 100 or so Romans. It was an absolute rout. Well, after three interventions in Macedon, the Romans had finally had enough of the Antigonids, and they disbanded the Antigonid kingdom after the Third Macedonian War. This marks the end of the history of Antigonid Macedon. They created instead four independent republics out of the former territory of the Antigonid kingdom. These republics continued to exist until 150 BC, when a pretender, a man called Andriscus, appeared in the countryside, claiming to be the son of Perseus, the son of the last king of the Macedonians. Peasants and others flocked to his banner, and the Romans were forced yet again to send an army into Macedon in what's called, sometimes called, the Fourth Macedonian War to put down this rebellion. They had succeeded in doing so in 148 BC, and when they had done this, they decided that enough was enough, and they finally created, out of the former kingdom of Macedon, they created a new province, Macedonia, a new province of the Roman Empire. This then gave them their first permanent foothold in the Eastern Mediterranean. As a footnote to all of these incidents, I should comment on a rather significant event, which is the Greeks, now seemingly somewhat disillusioned with the idea of what the Romans considered to be the declaration of free Greece, rose in rebellion, in really quite a pathetic rebellion, in 146 BC against the Romans. They were, of course, instantly subdued. But as an object lesson to the Greek world, the Romans destroyed the ancient Greek city of Corinth in this year, in 146 BC. This is significant because in the same year, if you recall, they had also razed Carthage to the ground. And many scholars, and indeed many Romans themselves, looking back on their history, regard this date, 146 BC, as a turning point in Roman imperialism. It seems that now the expansion of the Roman Empire becomes much more violent, much more aggressive than it had been in the past. The destruction of major urban centres, two of the major ancient urban centres of the Mediterranean, Carthage in the west, Corinth in the east, by the Romans in the same year, was a very significant event that sent ripples around the civilized world. So much then for the Macedonian campaigns, which stretched out from the First Macedonian War in 215, begun in 215, down to the middle of the 2nd century BC, and the final annexation of Macedon as a province, Macedonia. In order to trace the Roman conflict with the Seleucids, we have to backtrack chronologically slightly to the end of the Second Macedonian War. After this war, if you recall, the Romans had declared Greece a free country, and they had then withdrawn their troops from Greece. But one of the Greek leagues, the Northern League, the Aetolian League, were somewhat disillusioned with the reward that they received from the Romans for their assistance during the Second Macedonian War. They were expecting to get all of a certain area of northern Greece, but they only got a small section of it, and this irritated them. So they played the nationalistic card, and they began to foment unrest against the Romans among the Greeks. More particularly, they appealed to Antiochus III of Syria to come and assist them in freeing Greece from Roman oppression, as they put it. Antiochus sent over a smallish army into Greece in 192 BC, which immediately saw the Romans counter-mobilize, sending troops back into Greece after a two-year absence, and the Seleucid force was thrown out of Greece by 190 BC. But the Romans were not finished. They wanted to teach Antiochus a lesson. They decided to invade the homeland of the Syrian kingdom itself. It didn't help, by the way, didn't help Antiochus' case with the Romans that he had in his court
Hannibal, of all people, who was still there, which also raised for the Romans the rather ominous possibility of large, well-trained, well-equipped Hellenistic armies under the command of the best general that they'd ever faced in the field. So all of these motives combined encouraged the Romans to send an army into Asia Minor, the first Roman army, to cross into the ancient heartland of civilization, into Asia Minor, that is to say modern Turkey, in 190 BC. This army was quite small, about 30,000 men, and was under the control of Scipio Africanus, the defeater of Hannibal. Marching south, they finally encountered a vast Seleucid horde at the site of Magnesia in south-central Turkey, slightly inland. This Seleucid army numbered, well, the ancient sources tell us it numbered 150,000, but that's probably an enormous exaggeration. It certainly could have numbered as high as 80,000. We're after all dealing with an extremely rich and well-organized Hellenistic kingdom here. We know that the Seleucids could field very large armies, so a figure of 80,000 would be quite reasonable. So we're looking at the Romans being outnumbered close to 3-1 in this conflict. In addition, the Seleucids had elephants, but they also had a new armament that the Romans hadn't seen before, quite a vicious type of weapon, scythed chariots. These are chariots that have built into the axles and sticking out at the sides of the wheels large scythes, which obviously rotate with the axle, and when sent in large numbers into an infantry force can cause appalling devastation. Despite all this, the Roman army stood firm and prevailed at the Battle of Magnesia. This was an enormous shock to the Hellenistic world and to observers of the day, that the Seleucids, one of the superpowers of the day, could be humbled by a Roman force, perhaps 3 times smaller than the Seleucid army, was some statement as for Roman military superiority. Antiochus was humbled, humiliated, forced to pay a vast war indemnity, because the Romans knew he could. They imposed a war indemnity of 15,000 talents of silver on him. That's an enormous sum of money, but no doubt somewhat extortionate, since the Romans knew the riches of the Seleucid kingdom. As a postscript, I should comment that from that point on, from the Battle of Magnesia onwards, Seleucid power was on the wane in the Near East. Eventually, by about 100 BC, the Seleucid kingdom had disappeared from the face of the earth, to be replaced by a eastern peoples called the Parthians. We'll be hearing about these people again, because they were to be ultimately to be neighbors of the Roman Empire in the east. The Parthians had originally been subjects of the Seleucids, but they rose up and overthrew their former masters, seizing control of their kingdom around 100 BC. It's a longer process than that, but by 100 BC then, we have seen the demise of Seleucid Syria and Antigonid Macedon. Two of the Hellenistic kingdoms have been humbled and have vanished from the face of the planet. As a result of this then, by about 160 or so BC, the Romans were in control of all of the Mediterranean lands. They took to calling the Mediterranean Sea Mare Nostrum, our sea. And in many ways it was a sort of Roman salt lake. For wherever the waters of the Mediterranean lapped upon the shores, either there was direct Roman control or indirect Roman influence. The size, the territorial size of the Roman Empire at this time in no way mirrors its hegemonic power over the Mediterranean lands. The Romans had only a handful of provinces. They had created a new province of Africa when they had destroyed Carthage in 146 BC, provinces in Spain. They had a province in North Italy, Gallia Cisalpina. They had Sicily, they had Sardinia and Corsica, and they had Macedonia. Not very many. In terms of the actual territorial extent of the empire at this time, it's not really terribly large. But in terms of its influence, in terms of its hegemonic power, it is enormous. Two incidents, I think, nicely illustrate this situation. In 168 BC, the Rhodians, allies of the Romans, attempted to negotiate, to act as mediators between the Romans and Perseus, king of Macedon, at that time involved in his war with the Romans in the Third Macedonian War. for whatever reason, the Romans were suspicious of this Rhodian action. It seems to us now, and seems to many Romans at the time, to have been fairly innocuous and decent thing to do, but some members of the Roman nobility were very suspicious of what the Rhodians were trying to do. And as a result, the Romans destroyed Rhodes, not physically, but economically. They destroyed Rhodes with the single decree of the Senate. All they did was declare that a neighbouring port, the island of Delos, was immune from taxes. The source of Rhodian power had always been trade and levying, of course, port duties and taxes on trade ships that came through their harbours. But now they found all their former customers going to Delos instead. With a single decree, Rhodes was humbled and was no longer a major, even a minor player in the affairs of the Mediterranean. But I think even more colourful and more illustrative is the second incident. The successor to Antiochus III, the man defeated by the Romans at Magnesia, was Antiochus IV, king of Seleucid Syria. Something of his personality can be garnered from the fact that he called himself Antiochus IV Epiphanes, God on Earth. The Seleucids had always been rivals of the Ptolemies in Egypt, and when internal disputes within the Ptolemaic dynasty offered an opportunity, Antiochus IV began to intervene. He intervened under the guise of assisting one of the two sides in the internal dynastic dispute within the Ptolemaic dynasty, but in fact, it looks like he had designs over control of, if not all of Egypt, certainly parts of it, especially the Nile Delta and the valuable city of Alexandria, a major port then and now on the Mediterranean coast. Antiochus, at the head of a large, no doubt spectacular, military force, showed up in northern Egypt. The losing side in the dynastic dispute within the Ptolemaic dynasty appealed to assistance from Rome. The story goes that a Roman embassy was sent out to talk sense into Antiochus. The embassy was comprised of one man, Gaius Popilius Linas. He was a ex-consul, an old, wizened Roman senator. He appeared before Antiochus, in front of their army, in front of Antiochus's army, dressed only in his toga and accompanied by his two attendants carrying the fasces, the signs of his imperium, the signs of his power, of his Roman authority. Here we have Antiochus in his full armour, with his army behind him, facing a single, aged Roman senator. Antiochus steps forward and stretches out his hand to greet the Roman senator, who simply looks back impassively and does not extend his hand in greeting. He orders Antiochus to return to Syria and will not shake his hand until he has agreed to do so. Antiochus is completely nonplussed, dithers, hesitates, at which point Popilius takes his staff and draws a circle in the sand around the king. Walks around him with his staff, draws a circle in the sand, and says, "Unless you give me an answer to your quest, to my demand that you return to Syria, before you step outside that circle, consider yourself to be at war with Rome." Antiochus turned around and went back home. The mere threat of conflict with the legions was sufficient to turn back a significant armament, well-equipped, well-led, well-trained armament from the borders of Egypt. Egypt, after all, being a friend of the Roman people. This is true power. True power, as far as the Romans were concerned, at this time, was not controlling territory. It was just this sort of incident, telling people what to do, and they obeyed. Truly, the rise of the Roman Empire in this period is a remarkable achievement. Polybius was entirely correct in stating that it was, up to that time, one of the most remarkable things that had ever happened in human history. The Romans had emerged in the space of merely 50 or 60 years, if we start with the end of the Punic War, and conquered all of the major superpowers of their day in battle, and now extended their hegemony in such a way over the empire, over the Mediterranean lands, that an unarmed Roman senator could turn back a Hellenistic king at the head of his troops. In the next lecture, we'll seek explanations for how and why this happened.
Lecture 15, Explaining the Rise of the Roman Empire.
Hello, and welcome to the 15th lecture in the history of Rome. We have, in the last two lectures, examined the rise of the Roman Empire from an Italian power to a Mediterranean power, an event that took place with meteoric rapidity and startled the contemporaries of the age. What I want to do today is examine with you the explanations for this event. How and why did this happen? If we recall, the Greek writer Polybius was stimulated to write his history of Rome specifically to answer this question: under what circumstances the Roman people managed to gain control over what he considered to be almost the entire inhabited world. The Mediterranean culture was unabashedly Eurocentric, and the inhabited world were those areas that they were familiar with around the Mediterranean Sea. The answer to the question how it happened is very straightforward. The Romans didn't gain their empire by shaking people's hands and kissing babies. They gained it by fighting battles, as we saw unequivocally in the last three lectures. Battle after battle, war after war, almost continuously taking on new and more distant foreign powers, and always remarkably emerging victorious. Even if they suffered reverses, they were not invincible. But even if they did suffer reverses, they would always come back for more and eventually prevail. In most of the battles they fought, they were successful. And as a result of this, it's the simple, straightforward answer to the question, how did the Romans gain their empire, is answered by they had a superb military machine at their disposal. It was, in fact, the greatest military machine that the ancient world produced. So what I want to do for the first part of this lecture is outline to you the nature, structure, battle tactics and equipment and so forth of the Roman Republican Army. And then we'll turn our attention to the more difficult question of answering why did the Romans do what they do? What is it? What are the stimuli that lie behind Roman imperialism? The Roman army of the Roman Republic was not a standing professional force. It was levied ad hoc as it was required pretty much every year since the Romans had been used to, from earliest times, fighting against their Latin enemies and then their Italian neighbors and eventually the foreign powers of the Mediterranean, doing so really on an annual basis. Every spring, the consuls would hold a levy, which was called a legio, a selection. And this term legio is what gave rise to the basic unit within the Roman army called the legion. Originally, there would have been one Roman legion in the entire Roman army, but then as Roman manpower increased, as they gained control over more and more territory, there were two, four, and so forth, until they could eventually raise as many legions as they needed to fight a particular war. The legion was composed of citizen militia, citizen soldiers who provided their own equipment, and there was in fact a classification of the soldiers based on their equipment. And it was essential, therefore, for the full Roman citizen to have enough land, enough wealth, to be able to provide the equipment needed to fight in the army. Citizens who fell below this basic property qualification did not serve in the legions, since they couldn't provide their equipment. It stands to reason you don't want to have unarmed troops in your army. Each legion was an independent fighting unit. By the time that we're looking at in the 3rd century BC, roughly a 4,500 men strong. It was originally, it seems, organized tactically into the Greek-style phalanx, a single mass of heavily armed infantrymen. But sometime in the 5th, possibly as well, somewhat later in the 4th century BC, the Romans switched that basic tactical unit of their legion and changed to the Italian formation known as the maniple, which means literally the handful, the smaller tactical unit within the legion. Each legion was comprised of 30 such units. 30 maniples comprised the legion. The maniples themselves were further broken down into two units called centuries, supposedly 100 men strong, but actually comprised of 60 heavily armed infantrymen and 20 light-armed skirmishers per century. So each maniple would be about 160 men strong or so. Each century was commanded by an officer called a centurion, and these men were extremely tough. These were rank-and-file soldiers who'd made it up through acts of bravery in the field and had become officers. And as a result, they were extremely hard, tough-fighting men, these centurions. And there was a whole rank of them. If you were the chief centurion of the first century of the first maniple, then you were the head centurion of the whole legion. And you were practically one of the chief commanding officers of the whole army. The troops were further divided by age. This is an interesting feature of the Roman legion. There were 30 maniples per legion, but these were subdivided into 10 maniples each of certain age groups. We had three divisions, basically, depending on age and equipment. The one group were called the hastati, the spearmen. These were men in the prime of their life. Another group were called the principes, or front rankers. These were men were really overlapped considerably with the hastati, but were usually less experienced. And the third group were older veterans called the triarii, the men of the third rank, who held up the rear. They tended to be older men, men over 47. When the Roman army went into battle, it adopted a specific approach, a specific organization, tactical organization that the Romans called the Aquies Triplex, threefold battle line. And this is a good example of how effective the Roman legions were in battle. They would advance with the hastati in the foreground and the principes between them, arranged into their manipular formations. Behind them, in the third line, were the men of the third line, the older veterans holding up the rear. As they advanced, the light-armed and youngest troops of the army would dash out in front and harass the enemy line with small javelins and darts, generally trying to disrupt the enemy line as much as possible, while the main heavy infantry advanced further. Cavalry, by the way, in the Roman army was generally supplied by the allies. The legions themselves were really infantry units. It was the Italian allies who would provide most of the cavalry units. A small contingent of cavalry was attached to every legion, but it wasn't very significant. The cavalry armament was not something that the Roman legions themselves supplied for their armies, the allies. And recall again that we said last time, every Roman army was made up of at least 50% Italian allies in this period. Anyhow, to return to our Aquies Triplex advancing into battle, as the enemy came close, the gaps between the lines would be blocked up, the maniples would come together in close formation, engage the enemy. Then as the battle progressed, if a maniple became disrupted or fatigued, it could, upon a signal, withdraw from the line and be replaced by a fresh maniple from behind. This gave the Roman legion a remarkable flexibility in the context of an ancient battle. It allowed it much, much greater degree of malleability than was possible for most ancient battle lines. If we consider briefly what the Macedonian phalanx was like, this being one of the chief forms and most formidable forms of tactic in ancient warfare. This was a single block of troops, 18 or more ranks deep, maybe 20,000 strong, armed with pikes meters long, advancing shoulder to shoulder across a field. A very formidable formation, but not in the least bit flexible. It's not as if a phalanx could suddenly wheel and turn or carry out an awful lot of intricate manoeuvrings while battle was engaged. In contrast, the Roman legions could. They had a greater degree of flexibility. And this was revealed again and again in some of the battles that we examined in previous lectures. I'll just draw your attention once more to one of those battles, the battles of Cynocephali in 197 BC against the Macedonian phalanx in northern Greece, when the legions were being heavily pressed by an assault of the Macedonian phalanx. One enterprising Roman officer detached 20 maniples from the right wing of the Roman army and assaulted the unformed left wing of the Macedonian phalanx. And then, having defeated that, wheeled his 20 maniples around and came down
upon the successful wing of the Macedonian army, ensuring Roman victory. That degree of flexibility, being able to detach a section of the line to operate independently of the rest, was not a capability that most ancient armies had, but it's one that the Romans had. The soldiers themselves were armed variously, but the heavily armed infantryman would have as defensive equipment a helmet, a small breastplate, maybe a chainmail coat. He would have a greave on one of his legs, usually his forward leg, the left leg, and he carried a large shield, a large oval shield that was called a scutum, that stretched basically from the chin to midway down the shin, so a very large shield indeed. As offensive weaponry, he carried a short cutting and stabbing sword, which the Romans picked up from the Spaniards, so it was called the Spanish sword, the gladius Hispanius, and he had two javelins. And the javelins were of a particular design, extremely clever and lethal design. They had a long, thin spike at the top, narrow iron spike barbed at the end, about a meter long, attached into a wooden shaft. One javelin was light and one javelin was slightly weighted. When the order to charge came, the Roman legionary would rush forward and throw his light javelin in a volley into the ranks of the enemy. One must imagine for a moment the devastating effect such a volley would have had. Maybe 15 or 20,000 javelins descending into the ranks, these meter-long spikes. If you got hit by one, you would be transfixed, literally transfixed, and this would have an appalling psychological effect upon your neighbours. It wouldn't be exactly encouraging as you engage the legions. If it stuck in your shield, the long, meter-long iron spike at the front would buckle, and it would prevent you from pulling the javelin out and throwing it back at the Romans. It would buckle, and then it would act as an impediment on your shield. It would be stuck, barbed into your shield, and you'd have this javelin. As you were trying to deal with that first volley, in came the second volley of weighted javelins on top of you, and then, as you were trying to recover from that, you'd face the mass of the legionaries pushing forward with their large shields, and the deadly, short, stabbing swords flicking out between the shields, dealing death in no short order. So altogether then, ancient Roman legions are a very formidable tactical unit, and this is one reason, the chief reason, why the Romans were so successful in their conquest of the Mediterranean. They nearly always won, even in the face of overwhelming odds. The Roman army was also highly disciplined, extremely well organized. As an example of this, for instance, I'll mention their marching camp. It seems that they picked up the idea of the marching camp from King Pyrrhus of Epirus, who invaded Italy, as we saw, in 281 BC and stayed around until 275. The Romans, by the way, always happy to adapt and learn from their enemies' good points. They thought that the marching camp was a splendid idea, and in their typical fashion, they systematized it, organized it, and made it into an absolutely standard entity, which every army, upon completion of the day's march, would construct. The camp had a rampart and a ditch around it. The rampart was topped with a wooden palisade, and within the camp, the layout of individual tents, commander's tents, officer's tents, and then the individual legionaries' tents, organized by legion, by maniple, and by century, every time located in the exact same spot in the camp, were absolutely systematized. So once the camp had broadly been laid out, the army could march in, and every soldier would know exactly where he was going to go to set up his tent. A good example of this takes place in 168 BC, just before the Battle of Pydna, when the Roman general Lucius Aemilius Paulus faces Perseus's Macedonian troops, but his army has just completed a march. Paulus is unwilling to engage his men when they're still fatigued and hungry, so he draws up, with some maniples, he draws up a false battle line, and this keeps the Macedonians at bay. They think that perhaps the Romans might be doing battle, but behind his false battle line, he has the rest of his army construct a camp. And then as soon as the camp is completed, on a trumpet sound, the battle line in good order retires into the camp. The Romans are now safe behind the ramparts. Everyone gets a good night's sleep, a good meal, and then the next day they come out and wail on the unfortunate Macedonians, killing 20,000 of them, as we saw. So the marching camp then, a good example of Roman discipline and good order and organization. Finally, just briefly, I'll mention the strict discipline that pertained within the Roman army. This is something that no modern army would have the willingness to put up with, the way that the Romans enforced discipline. If a sentry, for instance, fell asleep
on his duty. The common punishment was for him to be beaten to death with clubs in the centre of the camp by the men of his own century, on the logic that he had endangered their lives. This was called fustuarium. It was a nasty and vicious punishment meted out to soldiers, primarily soldiers who were guilty of abject dereliction of duty, such as falling asleep on sentry duty during a camp. But cowardly or undisciplined behaviour, especially on the part of whole units, was also punishable. The Romans didn't find it effective to execute an entire unit, so instead they developed a system called decimation. They would take a unit that had abandoned its post or behaved in a cowardly fashion in battle or had been judged to have done so, and they would then draw lots, and every tenth man in that unit would be subjected to beating to death with clubs in the camp. But in the typical Roman fashion, they mirrored or matched the stick of discipline with the carrot of rewards, and there were also substantial rewards available to the soldier who performed well. There were various crowns and medals. There was the possibility of being summoned in front of the army and praised by the commanding consul in person, by name. So, strict discipline, but also a complex system of rewards to ensure that the soldiers fought to their best potential every time. And let's not forget, of course, a point I've made before in closing on the Roman army, its enormous resources of manpower as given to the Romans by their confederation of Italy. This is something that, again, is a cardinal feature of the Roman armies, the fact that they're able to continue to raise them, even when whole armies have been crushed and annihilated, as they were by Hannibal, for instance. It was always possible for the Romans to raise new troops rapidly, a further feature of their military system. So much then for the how of the rise of the Roman Empire. Their army was simply the best there was. I say it wasn't invincible, but it was the best that the ancient world had produced. As to the issue of why it happened, this is a more difficult question and has been exercising the minds of people since the Roman Empire first made its appearance in the 3rd and 2nd centuries BC. Polybius came up with an interesting layered reason for the rise of the Roman Empire. He said that the overarching reason, the sort of overwhelming, deepest reason for the success of the Romans was in the rotation of fortune's wheel in human affairs. He had a sort of a bigger view of the famous 15 minutes of fame idea, which was that everyone gets a shot at the cake. Some people will be favoured by fortune for certain periods, others at other periods, and this is the Romans' time. That was his most fundamental explanation. He is quite clear, however, that he doesn't believe that the Roman Empire is the product only of luck. He points out to two features of their society and their organisation that he believes were essential for the success of the Romans in forging their empire. First of all, he points out their military system. He figures that their army was close to invincible. That's an issue that we've dealt with already. Secondly, he points out the stability and balance of the Roman state. He's convinced that among polities that he's familiar with, the Roman Republic is an extremely well-balanced, cleverly constructed state that allows the Romans a high degree of internal stability. An internal consensus allows them then to focus their attentions more closely on external expansion. Now, the Roman state, the shape of the Roman Republic, is something to which I'll devote two lectures shortly. So let's put that aside and look at some other ancient explanations. What did the Romans say about why they had their empire? Well, the fact is, the Romans didn't do a lot of soul-searching about why they had their empire. For them, it was the natural order of things. They had their empire because they were just so good. They were efficient. They were frugal. They were able to put up with hardships. In their own minds, they were not terribly greedy or ambitious. And as a result, they had gained their empire, to a certain degree, they believed, by virtue of their excellent qualities. Another dominant view, at least very prevalent view that seems to come through from the Roman sources about why they had their empires, is to do with their gods. As we'll see in a later lecture when we examine Roman paganism, it was the belief of ancient paganism that one's piety and devotion towards the gods would be rewarded in this world, in material benefits for oneself. And so, if the Romans had their empire, it was because their gods favoured them. And they favoured them because the Romans were so devout and attentive to the worship of their gods. So in a certain way then, the Romans believed that they got their empire as a gift of the gods. Later on, some vague notion appeared, especially stemming from the idea that the Romans had gotten their empire by virtue of their excellent qualities, their excellent moral qualities. Vague notion appeared that the Roman Empire was there to dispense justice and good order to the world. Sort of an ancient version of the white man's burden thesis of empire that was popular in the last century. Civilizing the world. We're out there because the world needs us to be out there. It wasn't a very well formulated idea, but nonetheless, hints of it can be found in later authors like Cicero, for instance. But by and large, it must be said, the Romans themselves didn't do a lot of soul searching about why they had their empire. That's been a subject that's exercised the minds more of modern scholars than it did ancient ones. And let's turn our attention now to some modern explanations, modern views of why the Romans expanded so rapidly in the 3rd and 2nd centuries BC. Various ideas have held sway over the years, and I'm going to just outline three of them to you, three of the more influential ones. In the last century, the great German historian of ancient Rome, Theodor Mommsen, formulated the notion of defensive imperialism. He examined the Roman ideas that they never fought an unjust war, that all the wars they'd fought had been either in defense of themselves or in defense of their allies. And he accepted this and looked at some other of the facts and came to the idea that the Romans basically forged their empire out of fear. Fear that was inculcated in them by the sack of Rome in 390 BC by the Gauls and even more so by Hannibal's invasion of Italy in the Second Punic War. Always wary, goes this view, always wary of external enemies who might try and do the same thing again. The Romans acted in a, what we would term today, a proactive way and basically tried to neutralize these threats before they ever came close to Italy or came close to effecting what Hannibal could have done. This defensive imperialistic view is, as I say, supported by attitudes that the Romans themselves had about never having fought anything but a just war. And also it seemed to explain certain actions of the Romans. For instance, we've seen how reluctant they were to annex territory. They fought three wars against the Macedonians before they changed the Macedonian kingdom into a province. This seems to be reflective of a reluctance to have empire, and so it seems to fit in with the defensive imperialistic view. This view basically was introduced by Theodor Mommsen in the last century, middle of the last century, and stood firm for nearly 100 years, and was the generally accepted view of Roman imperialism until quite recently. In 1979, William Harris of Columbia University formulated a very different view in a very influential book called War and Imperialism in Republican Rome. He turned the defensive imperialistic thesis on its head. He said, if we look at the facts, if we look at the nature of Roman society, especially their glorification of war as a value, the value system, not only of the aristocracy, but of the people, glorifying war, finding praise and glory most of all in war. If we look at various of the Roman religious institutions and rituals, for instance, the habit of certain priests every year to pray for the expansion of Rome's borders and boundaries, then we must conclude, says Harris, that the Romans were not defensive imperialists, but aggressive imperialists. They were fully aware of the benefits to themselves, economic, social benefits to themselves of empire, and they aggressively pursued a policy of expansion wherever they could. That's why they were fighting practically every year for most of their rise to power. This view, then, is more nasty Romans, the Romans as aggressive imperialists. The most recent approach that has emerged is one that's derived ultimately from the physical sciences. That's a systems analysis approach. This view says that the roots of the Roman Empire lie not with their beginning of their expansion in Italy against the Samnites, not even with their first Punic War against the Carthaginians, but right at the start in 753 BC with the foundation of Rome. The interlinking system of alliances that the Romans created among the Italian states is at the root of the rise of the Roman Empire in this view. Because the Roman Confederation was a system of military alliances that provided the Romans every year with an army. What do you do with an army? Well, you have to use it to fight. And as a result, you are in many ways forced to find wars to use your army in. You are driven by the system, the self-sustaining system, to expand, because your system of alliances is primarily a military one, and in order to maintain your dominance
over your allies, to maintain your position of ascendancy over them, you have to put them to use, and so you get involved in warfare. Constantly. I've given very brief précis of these views. Of course, they're a lot more complex than that, but these are the